Hi friends, I'd like to tell you about a book titled Walking Him Home, Helping My Husband Die with Dignity, a memoir written by Joanne Stubbs Kelly. In today's episode of the Death with Dignity podcast, Joanne sits down with us to discuss her book and shares her experiences supporting her late husband as they navigate life with a terminal illness. She discusses the writing and publishing process, the ups and downs involved with being a caregiver, and the idea that we all have the ability to experience a dignified death. Joanne's writing is truthful, funny, vulnerable, empowering, and emotional, but most of all, filled with kindness, compassion, and love. Thank you, Joanne, for sharing your and Alan's experiences with us, which is a resourceful and powerful gift you have given to the world. To all of our listeners, I encourage you to read a copy of Walking Him Home, Helping My Husband Die with Dignity. And until then, we hope you enjoy the episode.
All right, and welcome everyone to today's episode of the Death with Dignity podcast. I'm here with Joanne Kelly, author of a book that will be released pretty soon here called Walking Him Home. Joanne, we always like to start the podcast by giving our guests just a chance to tell them and our listeners a little bit about themselves. So fill us in. Tell us, give us a little background about who you are, maybe where you're at, any family or information that you'd like to share with the listeners.
Okay. So I'm really happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me today. I live in Boulder, Colorado, a very beautiful place. And my parents were educators. Like you, my mom had a degree in special education. And my dad, when I was little, he was working on his PhD in education. And so we moved around a lot as he did different fellowships and grants and whatnot. So I went to lots of different schools. But the thing that always made me feel at home was when I had my nose stuck in a book. And that is still true to this day. I love to read. I love to garden. I love to be out in nature. For years, I did a lot of hiking, but as I've aged, I'm more content to go for walks rather than going on rigorous hikes. But mostly I enjoy my garden in my free time. And I write. My degree is actually in fine arts. I have a degree in pottery. I worked for years with my degree in pottery, writing marketing materials for high-tech companies. And I think that I was mostly looking for a job that combined my sort of expressive and creative self with my my mathy side of my brain, my more scientific side of my brain. So, you know, one of the careers I considered was in architecture, and, you know, I just needed something that put the two together. So it turns out that marketing for high-tech companies was a good combo for me. And I worked with some fabulous people at a lot of really great companies, and I learned a lot. But what I learned was not about writing memoirs, it was about writing marketing materials. So I found myself in a whole new field when I sat down to write this book.
Thank you for sharing that information with us. And certainly you're in a great spot in Boulder and very conducive to some of those activities that you enjoy. So good for you. Out of all the places that you've kind of bounced around and been, which one would you say is your favorite?
Well, Boulder.
Yeah.
I've been here now for 35 years, I think, which makes me almost a native.
Absolutely. Did you move there with your parents, or did you stumble upon this after, you know, school and just going through, your adult years?
So I've been married three times, And I stumbled into Boulder after my first divorce. My husband and I and my two kids were living in California, where my husband had gotten a really great job. But 2 years later, they shut down the plant. And we got a divorce, and he moved to someplace like Kentucky. And I moved to Colorado. So I had a sister in Boulder, and I had a brother in Fort Collins. And I initially moved to Fort Collins and then just sort of drifted for jobs to Boulder.
Excellent. Yeah, you wrote a little bit about that in your book, and that kind of brings us to that piece. Is this the first book that you've written and had published?
Absolutely, it is. I mean, I've written lots and lots of things that have been published, but they're more like data sheets and technical papers and those sorts of things, and some PR as well, but never a book. And I had considered writing a book several times in the past. You know, in the book, you read a little bit about my dad coming to live with, both of my parents coming to live with us, and getting my dad's car keys away from him was such a traumatic event for both of us that I thought, you know, there really should be a book out there on how to take the car keys away from your parents, because it was just really, really hard. So I have considered a few other books along the way, but because I needed to make a living, I couldn't both write a book. Well, I didn't think, at least, I could both write a book and make a living. So it wasn't until I retired from my paying job that I decided it's time. Okay, I'm ready.
Yeah. And I think it all comes together, you know, for a specific reason, and waiting must have been the right reason, because I really, really enjoyed your book. It is a beautiful read. It's compassionate, and it is funny, and it's sad. And there, I feel like you hit on so many different emotions that we experience as people. And that's why it is so relatable to really anyone who's going to pick it up. So to all of our listeners, really encourage you to pick up Joanne's book here. Tell us the title of your book.
It's Walking Him Home, Helping My Husband Die with Dignity. And I just want to point out that my original title for it was Walking Him Home, Helping My Husband Die a Tender Death. And it was my publisher who changed it to Death with Dignity. And of course, that was because she thought that I would have more recognition, that that would be something that people would search on, and therefore they would find my book. But in reality, so on my website, I have a blog. And on this blog this month, I had a guest blogger, Dr. Jean Abbott, who chided me for using the term death with dignity in the title of my book. And I thought I'd share this with you just because you use the same title in your podcast, and that is, people now associate death with dignity with medical aid in dying. And her point is, there are lots of ways to die with dignity. You don't have to use medical aid in dying to die with dignity. So you can be in hospice and die with dignity. You can die without any help from anybody and die with dignity. But we've kind of co-opted that term, death with dignity, when we talk about medical aid in dying. So I just wanted to put that out there, that that's something we should be aware of when we talk.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And actually, we had a guest on here previously on our podcast who shared the same thing. I believe it was Dr. Tom Cummings. And he is—he works as basically the manager and oversees a hospice facility. And he had pointed that out to me as well. And I had never really considered that as much. And I kind of always did, as you mentioned, intertwine the idea of medical aid in dying with death with dignity. And I feel like certainly the point you just made is very important to understand and establish. And another piece that when we consider language and really just how important this is, and in fact, it even reminds me in your book, you shared a little piece about it. Language matters. It's important, right? And absolutely, certainly it's important to differentiate something like the idea of death with dignity, which is something that is obtainable for all, as you mentioned, yeah, whereas something like medical aid in dying is a different process. And ideally, yes, it will result in a dignified death. One of the pieces that I've noticed throughout this experience with the podcast, and it's something I try to stay away from, is the idea of calling this assisted suicide. And for example, I feel like there is that concept of assisted suicide, but something for medical aid in dying is very, very different than that, in that I feel like most of the people who are in the position in which they need to access medical aid in dying generally have a strong will to live, do not want to be in their position that they're likely forced into with some sort of terminal illness, not by choice naturally, and want to live. It's just inevitable that they will die, and something like MAID provides an option to leave that suffering.
Right. I agree 100%.
Yeah, and I guess I'm thinking back to an interview I had with a doctor. Her name's Dr. Gaudiani. She supports people who have eating disorders, and we had a very in-depth discussion about, she had supported three of her patients with medical aid in dying. But I was very, kind of discouraged in a sense, because her patients in this study displayed a lot of other characteristics, such as suicidal ideation. And to me, what I took away most from that discussion was that it almost seemed like she was supporting them in the sense of something that was more like assisted suicide. Whereas, again, we're in a position where medical aid in dying is, you know, generally used for people who, again, want to live. And I guess in her study, all the patients had that big comorbidity of suicidal ideation. So that to me was very different. What she was doing, I would have said that to me seems like assisted suicide, whereas our position where I'm at is certainly medical aid in dying. I guess a long-winded answer to say, I love your point. Language is very important. That's something that I definitely will reflect on and consider, especially as I move forward and we talk with our listeners and learn more about the concept of a dignified death, as well as the topic of medical aid in dying. Right. So thanks for sharing that piece. That's really important. And how do you feel about it? I mean, do you kind of see that difference too? And
absolutely. And I believe that it is people who are against medical aid in dying who use the term assisted suicide for it. Just the columnist George Will says that medical aid in dying is for preventing a hideous death, not for truncating an unhappy life. And I think that's just a perfect quote to really describe what you just said, that people who die using medical aid in dying want to live. My husband, Alan, wanted to live to be 95 and to see his granddaughters graduate high school and get married and have families of their own. He really, really wanted to live for all of that. But once it was really clear that he didn't have a choice, he was going to die, he wanted to use medical aid in dying because he didn't want to suffer. And I'm not just talking about pain. I'm talking about just not being able to find joy in life anymore. It's that kind of suffering, not being able to take care of his own body. He didn't feel like he had any control over his life. And the idea of ending it on his own terms was very, very appealing to him, which is what he did.
Yeah, absolutely. And you hit on it, the kind of the mental anguish and the mental suffering is just as, you know, difficult to manage versus the physical piece. And at least with something like physical pain, there are times where medication can help with that. Whereas when you, start to suffer mentally and lose, you know, joy in the little things, it makes, that's hard. No one can really fix that and no medication can. And I totally agree with what you're saying here. And I want to be real careful about talking about your book. I want to share with our listeners about it, but I also don't want to spoil stuff because I really want people to pick this book up when they get a chance. And so I want to ask, before we really dive in, can you tell us how you decided to write the book? You talked about how you knew you always wanted to write a book. What made you lean in this direction? Was that just kind of the universe unfolding and you thought this has got to be it? This has got to be the first book? Or was it more like you had other ideas and then just kind of went in this direction, I suppose?
So I need to confess that I was petrified of writing a book. It wasn't something that I just couldn't wait to get started. It was a very scary thing to me. I think probably because I had a very critical father. And he published a list every year at Christmas time of all the errors that he had found in books. And so I had to wait for him to die before I could write a book. I say this with some joking because, yes, I was scared, but I'm not sure it was all attributable to my dad. It felt like a huge undertaking to talk about my life. And just, it's sort of, when you write a memoir, it's like standing naked in front of the whole wide world. And that I found really, really intimidating. So yes, I wanted to write, but I also was afraid of writing. But when it was really clear that Alan was sick, and I thought I was going to write about his illness, which was multiple system atrophy, which is a fairly rare illness. It's like there's one in 100,000 cases of population per year. So it's not something that a lot of people have even heard of. But in any case, the first thing I did, and the first thing I always do when I'm faced with a new situation, is go find how other people have navigated the situation that I'm finding myself in. And when I went looking for a book about medical aid in dying, I only found one, and it was not written by the spouse of someone who was going to die using medical aid in dying. It was written by the mother of someone. And it's different being married to someone and being the mother of someone. And so I really was bereft that I couldn't find a book by a spouse about the process of using medical aid in dying. And so that's when I knew what my book was going to be about, when I went looking for the book and couldn't find it. So I started writing fairly early in Alan's illness and just keeping little notes. I'm not a journaler, so I don't have a long history of journals to go back and look at. But I started writing little vignettes about what was going on in our lives. And I joined a writing group, which was invaluable. And so I would share my little vignettes with my writing group, and they would give me feedback, and they would share what they were writing, and I would give them feedback. And that was just really, really helpful. And it sort of helped me figure out that this really was going to be a memoir. It wasn't going to be a novel. I wasn't going to try to fictionalize it. I wanted to be real. I wanted people to hear a story about my struggle as a caregiver as much as about Alan's decision to use medical aid in dying to end his life.
Beautiful answer. And I'm so happy that you went in this direction with the memoir piece, because it is so raw and real. The vulnerability that you display in your writing is empowering. And again, to all the listeners, make sure to pick up a copy of Walking Him Home. Really, really compelling. Tell me, what was the process like? So you said that you initially, and again, I appreciate too, thank you for sharing that just how big of a risk this was for you to take, that you felt afraid and petrified, as you said. And I think just for everyone listening and myself included, I mean, just another example of the opportunities that are available and that we, no matter, you know, the situation, I think with courage can kind of work at something to come up with, you know, something good and develop and grow ourselves. So just so cool that you put this together. You talked about how you were kind of creating notes along the way as Alan was ill. And I wanted, and then you talked about the writing process and joining a writing club. How did you come across the idea of like finding a publisher, and what was that process like?
Well, that's a longer story. So I did a draft of this book, and I wasn't sure it was ready for publication, but I thought I was close enough that a publisher would help me just fine-tune it and get it ready to go out in the world. So I started writing query letters. This is what you do to get a book published in the traditional publishing world, is you write query letters to agents, and the agents are the ones who are going to represent your book to the publishers. And I think I wrote 60 letters to agents, and I got no response from them, but I did get a few very sweet little notes that said, thank you, but we don't think this book is for us. And what I learned fairly quickly is publishing books about death is not real popular. Everybody says death doesn't sell. So publishers were, first of all, sort of already inclined to say, yeah, I don't think so. This is not for me. But there was also the problem that, you know, I'm already retired. Publishers would like, or agents would like, to represent young authors that they can stick with through their whole career. So they're willing to put in a little extra work to get their first book launched, because they're expecting a payback down the road as this person publishes more and more books. But because I'm already in my 70s, they're probably not looking at a whole lot of books from me. I may still have one or two in me, but I'm not so sure about that. So anyway, I got one note from somebody. So when you send a query letter to an agent, you send all sorts of information, but it's specifically what they ask for. They might ask for your first 10 pages, or they might ask for your first 5 pages, or they might ask for your first chapter, and they want a bio, and they want this, and they want that, and you have to send them exactly what they ask for. There's no going off and being creative in your query letters. You need to give them what they're asking for. So I got one letter back when I sent my first 5 pages asking to read my first 50 pages. And I was so excited. I thought, oh, yay, I've got a foot in the door. But after I sent them my first 50 pages, they decided, no, we don't think this is for us. So I was pretty discouraged. And so at that point in time, I hired an editor to help me get my book whipped into shape. And it's something I should have done before I sent out my query letters, but I didn't know that. So this editor was somebody I had taken some classes from. And she basically gave me one piece of advice, and that was, show, don't tell. And I think a lot of first-time authors make this mistake. I will tell you about what a charming and funny and kind man Alan was, rather than showing you by giving you a little scene. And so I had a lot of work to do after I got this feedback from this lovely editor. And so when I was all finished rewriting, I then took my manuscript to one of, it was called a manuscript boot camp. And it was a bunch of people bringing their manuscripts and giving each other feedback and that sort of thing. And from that workshop, I got the feedback that I needed to put some more information in the book about Alan as a healthy person, Alan and me as healthy person people before I went into the illness, because I wanted people to fall in love with Alan so that they cared. And so that's when I, after that workshop, that's when I went back and added the part about us falling in love with each other and getting married and that whole fun part of the story. So after that, I sent out a few more query letters and finally decided this is too much work. Not the writing of the book, not the editing of the book, not the rewriting of the book, but the trying to find somebody to publish it. And I found a book in the newspaper. I saw a review of it, of a book that was published by She Writes Press. And I thought, I think I'll look into She Writes Press and see who they are. And it turns out they call themselves a hybrid publisher. So they have some of the features of a traditional publisher and some of the feature of an independent publisher. And they teach you basically how to publish your book and help you with the process. So that was the right fit for me. And so it cost money. I had to pay them for these lessons that they were going to teach me about publishing a book. And it was a good investment. I'm glad that I chose to go this route. And I'm still learning. You know, we have a whole group of people who are learning together. It's our class, you know, our cohort that are all publishing around the same time frame as my book, which is August of 2022. You know, we share what we've learned with each other, and we give each other support, and it's a good environment. I am using She Writes Press to publish my book, and it was a good choice.
That sounds fantastic, right up your alley, and just another, as you mentioned, an opportunity to learn and grow. And to see Absolutely. That publishing side, what a valuable, as you said, an investment, really. Do you, real quick, did this process motivate you? Do you think that you'll continue to compose anything else in the future?
Well, that's a good question. And I have not come to an answer yet. And what I'm sort of doing is trying to leave an open space in my life for whatever comes next. And I don't know what it is. I mean, maybe it's to be an advocate for medical aid in dying. Maybe it's to write a book about mental illness, because I do have a son who had schizophrenia. He died in February. And I may write about his life. I actually was very involved in advocacy for people with mental illnesses before I became a pretty much full-time caretaker for first my parents and then Alan. So I've been very involved in trying to make the world a better place for people with mental illnesses and their families. So that was my motto for a long time. And so now I think my motto is to try to make the world a better place for people who choose to use medical aid in dying and their families. But I'm not sure yet. I'm just leaving it open. I'm asking the universe to please guide me, or asking Alan to please guide me in what I should do next. So it might be another book. It might be advocacy. But I know for sure that it's going to be resting for a while first, okay, because the caregiving that I did, both with my parents and with Alan, I mean, it was a work of love, absolutely, but it took a lot out of me. And I need to spend time in my garden. I need to spend time in nature. I need to recharge before I make a decision to do whatever the next thing is.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate your honesty and you sharing that with us. And that does lead me to the caretaker piece. It's such a vital role for anybody who is sick. And I feel like it's kind of, I mean, people are the unsung heroes, no doubt, when it comes to supporting, people with a terminal illness. And you've had a tremendous amount of experience, as you share in your book and briefly mentioned here on our podcast. Can you tell me a little bit about that role for you as the caretaker, kind of when it started for you and how it helped you, I guess, prepare for supporting Alan? And then also maybe how it's helped you grow as an individual.
Sure. My mom was the caretaker in our family. And my dad was kind of a gruff and, you know, he was always right kind of person. And, you know, I looked at the two of them and decided that I really would like to be like my mom. I would rather be a caretaker and a loving presence. I'd like to provide TLC to people who needed it. So, you know, in my teen years, I was pretty self-focused. I think that's pretty normal for a teenager. But once I became a mother and an adult, I, you know, whenever you have kids, you're a caretaker. Whether you're a father or a mother, you're a caretaker. And I think that's where I really figured out what that role really involved. And when my mother started having problems with her memory, I really wanted her to have some TLC in her life. And it just didn't feel like my father's strength was in providing TLC for her. And so I was trying to do what I could to take care of her. And of course, I've always been a caretaker to my son who had schizophrenia. So I had that experience for a long time of being a caretaker. But when my mother got sick, that's when I started flying back and forth to upstate New York where my parents lived to try to inject a little TLC, a little care and loving attention into my mother's life. And I finally decided that it wasn't going to be possible because my father was very, very focused on money. And, you know, I would set up some caregivers to come in and provide care and my father would cancel it. And even though he agreed up front, he would cancel it. And it wasn't that he didn't have the money to pay for these services. It was that he was saving it for a rainy day. And he didn't view my mother's illness as a rainy day. He figured he could handle it just fine. So no matter what I tried to set up long distance, it didn't work. And even trying to support my dad, because I could see signs of him having memory issues as well, he even canceled those plans. So I finally convinced them to come out and live with my husband and me, with Alan and me. And that was a real eye-opener to see both of them outside of their the environment where they were comfortable, to see them in a new environment. I really got to see both of their deficits on a much different level. So, I mean, my mom, it was already clear she had already been diagnosed with Alzheimer's at that point in her life. But anyway, I fed my mom. I bathed my mom. I put her to bed every night. And it was a heart-filling experience. It was really, it filled me up to do that. But it was also exhausting, as I'm sure you're probably aware. And so then my mom died. And I talk about that in my book. And then, so it was just my dad living with Alan and me. And he was much harder for me because we had already always had friction in our relationship. And the friction was not because he was a bad man. It was because he wanted desperately for his children to live a very structured life according to his idea of what that should look like. And that was not the kind of life I wanted to live. And so we We butted heads a lot. He didn't speak to me for 14 years, actually, because of our head butting.
Yeah, you mentioned that in the book. And it's interesting. Some of his characteristics reminded me of like my grandpa, who I was really, really close with. And it almost just seems like just kind of that generation, right? Like a different generation, different upbringing, perspectives. And not that there's anything wrong with it, right? Just very different than, I guess, how things are operating today. Right. So I can imagine, you know, it's certainly there might be some friction there. And then with you, you're so, I mean, just from reading your book, you seem like such a strong and independent and driven individual. Maybe that's something that he didn't really anticipate as much, I guess.
Oh, he wanted me to be strong and driven, but he just wanted me to be a success as a teacher or some other way than what I chose, the route I chose. And so anyway, it was harder for me to caretake for my dad just because of our relationship. But when he was really getting, you know, when he fell and broke his hip and he was really getting to be hard to care for because of his infirmities, was also around the time that I realized that Alan was really sick and that I couldn't do both. It was really clear to me that it was too stressful trying to caretake my dad and Alan at the same time. And so we decided to move my dad to first an assisted living facility and then a memory care facility where he could get the exact kind of care he needed. And it, you know, I still went and visited him frequently and I still read to him and I still took him on outings and all those kinds of things, but I wasn't responsible for his day-to-day care. And so then I could focus more on Alan's day-to-day care. And so, you know, I'm not going to pretend that it wasn't hard. It was hard. But this is something that you do when you love somebody. And so you do it from your heart and it's good.
Yeah, it is a very difficult role. There's no doubt. And you've had a lot of practice with it. Did you ever anticipate? I mean, I guess no one anticipates something like, you know, that you've gone through or getting sick or a terminal disease. But what was it like when you and Alan first realized that he wasn't feeling too well? Can you give us a little preface of that? And I know you talk about it quite a bit in your book, but just maybe kind of, yeah, to describe to our readers what that process was like, discovering his disease and such.
Well, first, I do a lot of research online when anything comes up. You know, I want to find the book. I want to find the website that's going to give me all the answers. So when Alan started, his first symptom was he started acting out his dreams when he was still sound asleep. He was unaware that he was acting them out, and he would hit and punch and yell and scream, and they were usually very violent dreams. And it was really scary for me, but of course I went online and figured out what the name of that was. It's called REM sleep behavior disorder, and you know what it meant and you know what the possible outcomes were. But anyway, that can be a symptom for a lot of different illnesses. It's not just associated with the illness that Alan had. But as Alan developed more and more symptoms, his inability to control his bladder, his inability to control his bowels. I mean, he would stand up and he would faint. Sometimes it was just so many things. And I did more and more research of course we were going to doctors this whole time too. It wasn't just me trying to diagnose him at home. But the doctor said, and these are not his exact words, but the message Alan and I both got was, come back when you're sicker and then we'll be able to tell you what you have, which I didn't find very satisfactory. So I continued to do my research, and I decided way before the doctor was willing to call it that he had multiple system atrophy. And it's related to a number of other diseases, um, PSP and CBD and all sorts of different diseases that I know less about. But we joined a support group, and that was really good. It was a support group of people who had all of these types of atypical Parkinsonian illnesses. And so there were other people with multiple system atrophy in that group. And so we learned from them. And, you know, I decided early on that that's what he had, even though he didn't have a diagnosis. We went ahead and joined the support group, and we saw people who had similar diseases that weren't quite the same. And so anyway, it was a very confusing time because I wanted the doctors to say, this is what you have, so that then we would have an answer. Because I have never been good. I talk about this in the book too. I've never been good with being in limbo. I want to know, even if it's bad news, I'd rather know than to be just wondering all the time. And so when we finally, Alan was finally diagnosed when he was 69 years old with multiple system atrophy. And from there, his disability just flew. He went downhill very quickly. And part of that was because he was diagnosed fairly late in life. Typically, people are diagnosed with MSA between the ages of 50 and 60 and 70, I guess. So Alan was at the far high end of the range when he was diagnosed. And people who are older when they're diagnosed do tend to go downhill much faster. So, you know, then we were dealing with walkers, and first it was walking sticks to keep him upright, and then it was walkers and canes, and then it was wheelchairs, and then it was an electric wheelchair. And so he just kept losing capability. He lost multiple system atrophy shuts down many of the functions that you do without thinking. So blood pressure and waste elimination and all those things that you don't have to think about, your body just takes care of. Multiple system atrophy just takes those away from you. And so Alan knew that if he did not use medical aid in dying, his ending was going to be long and drawn out, and he would be lying there in bed, unable to move, difficulty breathing, unable to eat. And he did not want to go out like that. He wanted control over what his ending looked like. And so we started talking a whole year before he died with the folks in our medical system who do palliative care about medical aid in dying. And he told every healthcare provider we talked to for years that he was interested in medical aid in dying. So he didn't want anybody to be surprised at the last minute that that's what he was going to choose if he had the opportunity. And we were actually quite worried that the timing of being approved for medical aid in dying was going to be difficult for him, because you have to show that you're mentally capable of making good decisions on your own behalf. And he was losing some of his cognitive skills. So that was one of the concerns. And you have to be able to have a diagnosis or a prognosis of 6 months or less. And you have to be able to ingest the medication yourself. And so we were really worried, was Alan going to be able to drink the poison himself because of all of the capabilities that he was losing? So it was really a matter of getting the exact right timing of him still being capable enough to make the decision, as well as him still being physically capable enough to drink the liquid. And so we worked really hard at finding the right window. And his medical team was very cooperative in helping him find that correct window. And he was ultimately approved for medical aid in dying.
How did you or Alan learn about medical aid in dying?
Well, we live in Colorado, which is a state that passed a medical aid in dying initiative. So we had to vote on it in 2016. But I think we both knew about it before then. Alan had always told anybody who had listened, way before he got sick, he told anybody who would listen that we treat our pets better than we treat our elders because we help them die when their suffering is just too much to bear. And so it's sort of like he believed in medical aid in dying before there was medical aid in dying, at least in Colorado. So we both voted for it when we had the opportunity, and Alan was just absolutely relieved and delighted when it passed. And so we also had another really good friend who used medical aid in dying before Alan did. And I talk about that in the book as well. So we had lots of exposure to it. It was not a new concept to us at all.
Yeah, you mentioned the animal piece, and I have to agree with you and just share that when I was first embarking on this process too, I would often think of my dog, Dora, who I had to put down a few years ago, and just think of how we show our animals so much compassion, yet we can't seem to do that for each other. And it's discouraging in a sense, but it's wonderful to see that this is now becoming, you know, with time more available and people are having more access to something like this. And it's obviously in a very specific situation. It's not like this is being offered to every single person on the planet, right? There's a lot in place to make sure it's for people who need it. Did Alan ever share with you and kind of talk about what were the most difficult parts for him as he was dealing with his symptoms and illness?
The hardest part for Alan was knowing that he wasn't going to be here to watch his grandchildren grow up. He really wanted to be here to watch Caitlin, his oldest granddaughter, graduate from high school, which she did this year. And I went in his place.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. And he wanted to see them go to college, and he wanted to see them fall in love, and he wanted to see them have kids of their own. And so that was definitely the hardest thing for Alan, was giving up that dream of watching all that happen.
Yeah, that's scary. And I definitely can relate. Now, what for you, I guess, kind of similar, piggybacking off of that question, what was for you the most difficult part as you were supporting Alan on his way out? And especially, like, if you don't mind talking a little bit about the process of, like, when Alan decided to use or, you know, go through with everything. And if you don't mind just sharing a little bit about that piece about it and how it impacted you and what was hard for you.
Yeah, well, coming to terms with his decision was hard for me, even though intellectually I agreed that everybody should have the right to end their lives if they were suffering. I believe that in my brain, but in my heart, I really, really didn't want Alan to die. I wanted him to stay with me and I wanted to grow old with him. And so it was really, really difficult to help him go through the medical aid in dying application process because I knew I was helping him end his life. And I had to keep constantly bringing myself back to what I was doing, helping him end his life the way he wanted to end his life, was a loving thing to do. But when I was first sort of facing the enormity of it, I was angry. I was really mad at Christmas, as a matter of fact, because it was at Christmas time that Alan told me that he was ready. And I was just so irritated by all the Christmas cards I got wishing me joy. And it was like, you don't understand. I cannot be joyful. My husband is going to die. He's about to die. And Joy is not something that I can wrap my arms around. And, you know, the decorations and the holiday cheer, it just drove me nuts. So I got through it. First of all, I asked Alan if he would be willing to wait until after the holidays to go through the medical aid in dying, the actual process of ingesting the cocktail, because I just didn't want his granddaughters and his daughters and me. I did not want to be mourning him every year at Christmas for the rest of my life. And what I have since learned is that I'm going to be mourning him at Christmas for the rest of my life anyway, but hopefully it puts enough time in between it for the kids that they don't have such a strong association between grandpa dying and Christmas. So that was really the hard part for me.
Thank you for sharing that answer. I wanted to ask, for yourself, in your relationship with death and dying, has that changed over the years? And if so, has it changed for the better? Do you feel like you are more comfortable or still seeking answers? Tell us a little bit about that piece.
Yeah, that's a good question. I learned through Alan's experience that dying doesn't have to be awful. It doesn't have to be a big, scary, painful experience of just complete and utter grief. It can be beautiful. It can be tender. It can be loving. And because I learned that from Alan, I learned a lot of important lessons from Alan, but because I learned that from Alan, I am now much less afraid of dying myself and much more of an advocate for medical aid in dying for anybody who chooses that route to end their suffering. I think it's a good way to die. It is a dignified way to die. It is a death with dignity, or it was for Alan in any case. So, that kind of brings it full circle to what we were talking about before. But yes, I am much more comfortable with death. And I think all of the people who were here for his dying, he was surrounded by people who loved him, which included two of his granddaughters and his two daughters and a couple of really, really good friends. And our minister came too. So, he was surrounded by people who loved him, and I would not be at all surprised if every single one of those people are now much more comfortable with death. And I would actually like to tell you a little story about Olivia, if that would be okay. This is from the book, and people will read it when they read it. But so Olivia, it was one of Alan's granddaughters. She was 12 or 13, 12 and a half maybe, when Alan was going through this. And she wanted to be here. She raised her hand and said, yes, I'd like to come, I think with encouragement from her mother, but it was still really hard for her. And we formed a big circle around Alan and held hands and told Alan stories and thanked him for all of the gifts that he gave us. And it was really touching. We laughed a lot. And then we took individual private time with him. And I had my final goodbye with Alan. And then he said, would you bring in my granddaughters now? And at that point, Caitlin decided she was done. She had come in for the circle, but that was all she was up for. But Olivia, Alan was going to be so disappointed if one of them didn't come. And so I kind of encouraged Olivia. I kind of grabbed her hand, gently pulled her into the dining room where the two of us could talk. And she just cried and cried and cried and looked at her feet and cried. And finally, she nodded her head that she was ready to go in and say goodbye to Alan. And I brought her into his room and I asked Alan if he had any final words for Olivia. And he said, He said, yes, he did. And it took him a minute to gather his thoughts. And then he said, Olivia, when you have important decisions to make, I want you to reach deep down inside and find the best Olivia that lives inside of you and ask her for advice. Ask her to guide you and listen to what she has to say. Do you think you can do that? And Olivia shook her head. She's still just crying and crying. And so Alan felt good that he had a closing word with her. And then she went and sat back in the living room. And later, when we went in to be around him as he died, the two preteens sat in the living room, and they couldn't be in there at that very final part. But a year, this is not in the book because it happened after the book closes, but a year after Alan died, we celebrated the anniversary by going to a park that's near here. It had to be outdoors because it was during COVID. And we spread some of his ashes and we told funny Alan stories. And we laughed a lot and cried a lot. But it was a good celebration of Alan. But I asked Olivia, I said, do you remember what your grandpa said to you that day when he said goodbye? And she said, yes. And I said, can you tell me? And she repeated that story almost word for word the way I remembered it. So Olivia, who's now 13 at this point in time, she carries this. I mean, right now she's 16, I think, 15. But she carries this piece of her grandpa inside of her, this piece of advice that I suspect she's going to carry with her whole life. And that just fills me with joy.
Yeah, that's a beautiful story. Thank you for sharing. And just a tribute to Alan too, and how he, even though he's gone, is still leaving a lot of good for people. So that is incredible. I wanted to ask a little bit, you talked about your minister being present at the end of Alan's life as well. And I wanted to ask, and you talk a little bit about being involved with church in your book. Can you tell us a little bit about that element of your life, I suppose? And I'm not sure if maybe some people didn't agree with the process of medical aid and dying, even people within your church and such. Did you ever have any backlash, or did your minister ever, I guess, question or, you know, not agree with the process?
There was not one iota of pushback from any of the people in our church. Well, our church is called Unity, and it's a worldwide denomination. But it's a New Thought church, which means we sort of have a metaphysical interpretation of the Bible. And, you know, the main tenet is that we are all one. And the most important thing about our church is the community that's there. And it's a community of very loving, supportive people. And many of the people that you met in the book were people from our church, like the woman who came and cleaned Alan's fish tank every 10 days for a couple of years because that was something he needed help with. She was from our church. And there are many, many other people who brought us meals and who did just so many kindnesses for us. Many of them were from our church. And it wasn't something that we talked about, except for with the ministers ahead of time. Well, I mean, Alan was very open with both of our ministers about what he planned to do. And he asked them lots of questions about the afterlife and what he should expect and all that kind of stuff. And they did their best to answer. But when we were right down to the end and we had a party for Alan, mostly we set up times for him to meet with his close friends individually before he died. But then here we were a couple of days before he planned to die, and we still had like 30 people that he wanted to say goodbye to. So I made a whole bunch of phone calls and sent out emails and invited people to come. At this point in time, he was living at a nursing home because I could no longer take care of his physical needs at home. He was just, I couldn't lift him myself, which made it really hard. So anyway, he spent the last 3 months of his life in a nursing home. So we invited all these people to come to one of the gathering rooms at the nursing home. And I just said, bring a memory to share with Alan. And we had some food and we had some beverages. And everybody came and said goodbye and shared their memories. And I talked about medical aid in dying then to the people who were gathered then. And of course, Alan had told our close friends about it when he had our individual meetings with them. But it wasn't like we got up and announced in church that this is what Alan was going to do. But then when we had his memorial service, I talked about it openly. And everybody was very accepting and very supportive. And they agreed that he had a very loving death. And so there was never one little bit of pushback from the people in our church. It was great.
That is great. That's absolutely phenomenal, especially because as it feels like the religious piece is one of the kind of hindrances for trying to get this more mainstream for people, I suppose. I wanted to ask is there anything specific that you wanted to share with our listeners about something that you learned from Alan? I mean, I'm sure it's so hard to pick just one thing, obviously. Maybe something that you learned from him during the medical aid in dying experience, or just during his illness as being, or during his time being sick, or even just when he was healthy, a memory or just something, a learning lesson, anything you'd like to share. And the book is filled with some really cool stories too, people. So this is a little teaser for you. But Joanne, if you have anything that you'd like to share with us, we'd love to hear that.
I do have something I want to share with you, but it's not necessarily something that's in the book. And well, it is. It's just a more subtle message in the book. And that is, I really encourage everybody to talk to your loved ones about what you want the end of your life to look like. Even if you are decades, what you expect, decades from the end of your life, you need to have the conversation, because you never know what's going to happen in your life. You can be young like Andrew and end up with a horrible disease like Andrew. So you need to have the conversation about what you would like your death to look like early, when you're young and when you're healthy, and share it not just with your family, but with your close friends. And just make sure you have it in writing. When Alan died, I redid my will. I redid my power of attorneys, my healthcare proxy. I redid all of that. So it was really clear who did what and what I expect, what I would like from them if I am ever in the position where I can't make my own decisions. So that's my final message to y'all.
That's a very important, and absolutely, people, you heard it from Joanne. Make sure to get those things in order, and it makes the process easier. And I'm learning too, if you unfortunately end up sick at the end of your life, it's so hard to do really anything. And then to think about having to, like, oh gosh, I got to do an advanced directive or power of attorney, and I'm feeling this way, like, no chance. So yeah, plan ahead a little bit. Life's, you never know. It's unexpected. Anything else, Joanne, that you would like to share about the book or life in general? I feel like this was such a good discussion, and we did a good job tiptoeing around the book, but I really, again, encourage people to pick up Walking Him Home by Joanne Kelly. It's a wonderful book.
So I would just like to remind people that it's Walking Him Home, Helping My Husband Die with Dignity by Joanne Tubbs Kelly. And the reason why the Tubbs is important is because apparently there's a Canadian actress named Joanne Kelly. And so if you Google Joanne Kelly, you're going to find her. You're not going to find me. So you have to Google Joanne Tubbs Kelly. But you can go ahead and order the book. We're only a couple weeks away from book release here. You can go ahead and order it any place where you buy your books, whether it's a local bookstore or whether it's online. You can order it now, and you'll be ready to share it with friends.
Absolutely. I wanted to ask, that's so exciting. Do you have like an official launch date? And then will you be doing any like book signing or just, I guess, advertising of it along the way?
Yes. My official date is August 9th. That's the launch date. And right now I have three book signings planned. One is in Boulder at the Boulder Bookstore on the 11th of August. And the next one is at the Tattered Cover in Denver. Well, actually, it's at their branch in Westminster. And that one's on August 18th. And then I do the big one on August 24th at my church.
Cool. Yeah. Wow, that is so cool.
Yeah, my minister is going to join me and we're going to have a conversation about the book rather than me just talking about it.
Oh, very neat. Very cool. That's wonderful. Thanks, friend. I have some family who live in Denver, so I will encourage them to try and come check you out and support you in this process.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Joanne Tubbs Kelly, again, our guest today, author of Walking Him Home, Helping My Husband Die with Dignity. It's been such a pleasure talking with you, friend. Thank you so much for taking the time. And again, a really powerful book, and your courage and vulnerability and taking that risk is, I think, going to help a lot of people.
Well, I hope you're right. Thank you very, very much for having me today.
All right, friend. Have a good day.
You too.